on Saturday with a high of 72. We do have a chance of light rain showers and storms come Saturday night. For Sunday, mostly cloudy with light rain showers likely in the morning, then a chance of showers in the afternoon. The normal high for this time of year is 59. The sun will set this evening at 6:04. Currently sunshine, temperature reading in Kenosha of 49, it's 45 in Lake Geneva. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The morning show with Greg Berg is coming up. Support for the morning show comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Jack Andrea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTDHD. I'm Gregory Berg, and I'm really happy to be sitting opposite James Schatzman, the artistic director of the Choral Arts Society, who is with us to talk about their new season and in particular about the performances that are coming up this weekend of Gilbert and Sullivan's Trial by Jury. In part two of today's program, I'm going to be speaking with Liz Wong, a highly regarded author of children's books, and she's the author of a book, a darling book, called Quackers, that has been selected for the Jumpstart event called Read for the Record, in which readers, young and old alike, but particularly parents and children, are invited within the space of a 24-hour period to sit down and read together the same book. Millions and millions and millions of people reading the same book, essentially at the same time. And this time around, it is Liz Wong's Quackers that has been chosen for the Read for the Record event, which is actually tomorrow. So we're going to hear all about that in part two of today's program. But in the meantime, James Schatzman, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. Good to be here.
Good to have you here. The last time we were here, we were talking about your day job, and remind our listeners what that is.
The way I feed my children and grandchildren is by working at an organization called Racine Vocational Ministry, where we help people get back to work, and specifically with homeless populations as well as people coming back from prison.
Very good. Today we're talking about what you do in quite a lot of your free time, such as it is, namely as artistic director of the Choral Arts Society. And the ensemble just celebrated quite a notable anniversary.
30 years last year, and very excited to have been involved in all 30 of those. And we're coming up, obviously, on our 31st season and opening with a bang this year.
Right. Gilbert and Sullivan's delightful operetta, Trial by Jury. We're going to sample the score right now. You're having us listen to essentially the way the operetta opens without going exhaustively into the full plot and so on. Just say whatever you think our listeners need to know in order to fully enjoy these next couple of minutes.
Well, this is actually a satire of the legal system in Britain at the time, and the plaintiff is suing the defendant for a breach of promise of marriage. Edwin has promised to engage her, and he's changed his mind, and she's taken him to court.
Mm, and there you go. And here is the opening of Gilbert and Sullivan's Trial by Jury. Just a little taste of this absolutely wonderful score by Gilbert and Sullivan. It doesn't quite have the prominence of Pirates of Penzance or the Mikado or HMS Pinafore, but it really should. I mean, it is certainly equal to those works in terms of the inventiveness of the music and the delightful story by W.S. Gilbert. I know the Choral Arts Society did this work a few years ago because I was part of those performances, and I have to say, going into them, I only knew the title of this piece. I'd never heard any of the music, and I was just blown away by what a marvelous score it is.
It's a remarkable score, and historically, it's interesting. I mean, Gilbert and Sullivan had done only one collaboration prior, their first show, Thespis. And I think both of them thought that was it. This was a wonderful opportunity for collaboration, and that was it. And then Doyle Carte, who hadn't really known them yet, was in a pinch. He needed a one act for a double bill with La Pericole, and he had seen this libretto and had known of Sullivan, and so he brought them together. And this is the first collaboration of the three of them coming together. Mm. It's also, as an operetta, as a distinction of being the only one without any dialogue. It's completely sung, and it really is a masterpiece. Some critics have called it the greatest one-act British drama ever written, and it really is. It's a delight.
It's also not all that long.
No, it's about 40 minutes. And so it's in and out. The action moves very, very quickly. I think people who are Gilbert Sullivan aficionados will really, really understand that this was the genesis of all those great shows, Penzance and others. And also that for those who really don't know Gilbert Sullivan very well, it's a great way to put your toe in the water and just kind of have an experience of what's all the fuss about. It's glorious music.
Mm. Say just a little more about the storyline. We gave just the kernel of what happened. Say a little bit more about kind of the arc of this story and maybe a little bit about what would have prompted Gilbert and Sullivan to be interested in a story like this.
Well, obviously, Gilbert was interested in the story. Sullivan had nothing to do with this. The libretto was already written before the collaboration was actually put together by Doyle Carte. And so Gilbert had training as a lawyer, and so his understanding of the legal system was quite extensive. Yeah. As such, this is pretty pokes a pretty big finger at the system itself. And really, the issue is Edwin is being sued for breaking off an engagement, which apparently was legal at the time. It was treated as a binding contract. If you agreed to marry somebody and backed out, you could be sued for that, although it rarely happened. So that makes fun of that issue to some degree. And in this particular operetta, there's a line that says that what Edwin has done is a very serious crime. So it's taken way over the top. And so Edwin, who's obviously fickle, has decided he's fallen in love with another woman and has jilted the plaintiff, the beautiful Angelina, of course. And unfortunately for Edwin, the members of the jury start falling in love with Angelina. And so the usher has encouraged them to be free of bias of any kind. And, of course, they're about as biased as they can be. And they're all hoping that the beautiful Angelina will fall in love with them. Mm-hmm. They realize her availability. In typical topsy-turvy fashion, the elderly judge decides that he loves her, and he will manipulate whatever he has to manipulate to get Angelina to notice him, which he does. And in the end, everything works out. It's like this big happy ending. Edwin falls in love with a member of the gallery who we've dubbed as Selfie Girl. We brought this into the 20th century, so reporters will be using their phones and taking pictures of the proceedings. And then the judge and Angelina also fall helplessly in love.
But what role does the chorus play in this?
The chorus plays two roles, actually three. The women are divided into two choruses, a chorus of bridesmaids and a chorus of members from the gallery who we've pretty much designed as a press corps. Hmm. And so the gallery is full of folks taking interviews, taking pictures, and film of this historic trial. And the gentlemen play the jury. And so that's their role.
We have not yet touched on one of the more remarkable aspects of these performances that are coming up this mm-hmm. weekend, and namely that is the location. I remember in those previous performances of Trial by Jury, those took place in Memorial Hall. Mm-hmm. But this is going to be taking place in a space that should be spectacularly appropriate for this. Tell our listeners about it.
We are very, very excited and enthusiastic to be performing in the Racine City Council Chambers at City Hall. This is something that has never been done before, and we're enthusiastic that this space it looks perfect for the setting of this piece. There's a glorious portrait of the first mayor with big lamb chops right over where the judge will be sitting, and also a very beautiful portrait of Jerome Increase Case on the back. So, and it's also been recently refurbished, so it's a stunningly beautiful space. The acoustics are fantastic, and so it looks like a courtroom. So it will be perfectly appointed for this. So the set is there. The set will not need to be set up.
Right.
It will not need to be torn down. That's a very nice aspect of this particular
Absolutely.
Opera.
So what did it take to bring this about? I don't know if you just said that or not. I don't remember. I know you said it before we went on the air that almost certainly a concert or musical performance has never taken place in that room before. How difficult was it to sell the city of Racine on this possibility?
It wasn't all that easy. However, in my professional life, I've been at City Hall and presented to council chambers on a couple of occasions. And on most of the opportunities that would go in there, I'd realize that trial by jury is a perfect opportunity. When I walked in, it just popped into my head. This would be a fantastic place to perform this particular work. And so we began discussions with the mayor's administrator, and she seemed very interested in that. And so we pursued it there with the mayor and the city administrator. And they agreed that as a one-off, that this is not going to be a new concert space in Racine, I believe. But in this particular operetta, in this particular setting, would be something that the city would really enjoy seeing.
Right. So did these discussions occur when Mr. Dickert was still in office, so under his administration?
Yes. We worked with Mayor Dickert and his city administrator, Tom Friedel.
Okay. And so it's a good thing that even when Mr. Dickert made his unexpected departure from office back in the spring, that this possibility didn't depart with him.
We're very glad that it didn't. And the mayor and the administrator made sure that all the appropriate people and departments were contacted so that this could follow through.
Fantastic. So have you had a chance yet? I'm guessing you have not yet rehearsed in the space. And what opportunity will there be, if any?
We are in that space Thursday and Friday to kind of get our marks and realize the blocking that we've done in other spaces will work. And so we have 2 days, which is enough. That's certainly enough for us to get our bearings. I've been in there a couple times with the director of the show, Paul Ivkovich, who directed them all in the Night Visitors, to just mark spaces out, make sure we're okay, whatever appointments we needed in the space to have them there, whatever appointments we didn't need to have them taken out for the performance.
Mm, very good. What kind of challenges does this pose for the Choral Arts Society musically?
Well, we're not an opera company, and that's always a challenge. And I guess by my nature, I always tend to think, oh, we can do this. This is not a big deal. I know people. We'll get this all worked out. And the deeper I get into it, again, the more respect I have for opera companies who do this routinely, who have to worry about sets and costumes and makeup and memorization. The chorus is not typically memorized concerts. And so for that purpose, this puts that in a different league altogether.
Wow. So you're, for instance, the Choral Arts, I mean, your chorus is going to be memorized for this.
Yes, they are.
Wow. And this is right off the bat.
It's right off the bat.
In terms of your season.
This is going to be a big season in a lot of ways, and we're very, very enthusiastic about the entire season. We've got some really exciting things happening.
Yeah. So you will be rehearsing in the City Council chambers Thursday and Friday, and then when do these performances actually occur?
Performances happen on Saturday, and there are two of them. Our first performance is at 3 p.m., and our second performance is at 7.
And that actually works out pretty nicely, doesn't it, in terms of time that you can, because the work is has such a modest length, and you're not doing anything besides it.
We're not doing anything besides it. This is the sole feature of the concert.
Right. So 40 minutes of delight with Gilbert and Sullivan with one of their very first collaborations, Trial by Jury, this Saturday in Racine's City Hall in the City City Council Chambers.
That's
what we call it.
That's correct.
And when people get to City Hall, is it easy to find this?
There's going to be very good signage. There are three doors that you can enter. There's the one right off of 6th Street. There's a parking lot behind on the west side of the building with three tiers of parking where you can park there and come in that door. And for anybody with accessibility issues, you would come in on the Washington Avenue side. There's a door there that involves some ramps and an elevator.
Mm-hmm. For those of you just joining us for part one of today's morning show, I'm speaking with James Schatzman, who is the artistic director of the Choral Arts Society of Southeastern Wisconsin. And their newest season, their 31st season of music making, begins with a bang this Saturday with two performances of Gilbert and Sullivan's delightful Trial by Jury. And again, as we've been saying, those performances, one in the afternoon, one in the evening, take place in the Racine City Council Chambers in Racine's City Hall at 730 Washington Avenue in Racine. All of that is quite a lot, but not enough to make a whole season, of course. And you have all kinds of things that are following thereafter, including something that's been a tradition of the choral arts for many, many years. How many years by now?
You know, I haven't kept track, but I bet it's about between 23 and 25 years. We've
Wow.
been doing it almost since the beginning.
Yeah. So explain to our listeners who might not be acquainted with this tradition what we're talking about with a concert called Lessons and Carols.
Lessons and Carols was an English innovation that is almost 100 years old. Next season, not this season, next season will be the 100th anniversary of the invention of Lessons and Carols, which is basically telling the Christmas story through Scripture from Old Testament through to the birth narratatives and interspersed with music, Christmas carols. It's become a tradition to choral arts that's very dear to us. And also, I would say the Western world. I mean, this has been being performed probably for 75 years at King's College in Cambridge on every Christmas Eve. And so it's broadcast live all over the world every year. And me being raised an Anglican, I grew up with listening to these performances when I was a kid. Mm. And so they just have a very special place, probably a disproportionately romantic feeling to me. I get very, very weepy when I think about listening to these as a kid and how much they meant to me, and how much they actually shaped my faith personally. To hear this music coupled with scripture in a way that was very moving. It's a glorious setup. It has a beautiful flow to it. And it's a great way to begin to remind ourselves what Christmas is all about.
So how closely does the choral arts lessons and carols adhere to, for instance, that lessons and carols service that many of us have heard over the radio on Christmas Eve Day?
It's clearly the model for me. I don't do a lot of innovating, and so the format that you hear is pretty much the format that you're going to experience at the Choral Arts. So it's very traditional. We do have a minister who leads us through it as it is a service, and so we've taken it pretty much as it is and presented the format as it's been done in England for decades.
Mm. I know this has been done in different spaces, and I think this year you're going to be doing it actually in a couple of different spaces over the course of two different performances. Tell us about those two spaces and why you're electing to use two different spaces.
Well, we're going a little bit back to our roots. The first probably 10 years of this program, we were presenting it at St. Luke's Episcopal Church in Racine, which is a glorious historic space in downtown Racine. And where I was also choir directing for 25 years, and so it was, it's probably one of the nicest spaces in town to do this particular format, just because it's set up similar as you might expect if you were in a collegiate chapel,
right.
And so
and a very reverberant acoustic for sure,
a fantastic acoustic, and one that's very, very favorable to singing. And so we're going back to our roots. We haven't performed at St. Luke's now for probably since 2008 or 2007. So it's been a long time since we've done our lessons and carols there. So we're very excited to be going back and taking part in that congregation's 175th anniversary. So this is their 175th year. Oddly enough, it's also the 175th anniversary of Sir Arthur Sullivan's birth. I didn't realize those came together so nicely till now.
Okay.
So we're excited to be back there. And we're going to be doing our first performance ever at First United Methodist, where Music at First is done in Kenosha. And so our second performance will be done at First Methodist in Kenosha on 60th Street.
Another beautiful, beautiful place for making music.
So. And a place where people are very accustomed to going to hear fine music as well.
Yeah. So that's going to be the first weekend in December, then December 2nd and December 3rd, the Choral Arts Society's Lessons and Carols. In the spring, you have a performance coming up that I know you are tremendously excited about, and it involves one of the towering masterworks of the 20th century.
It really does, and even saying that puts a little chill down my spine. This will be the largest production we've ever done. We have done Carmina Burana twice before. In fact, you were one of our soloists in years past, and it's a masterwork for sure, and I would assume that a lot of our listening audience knows of this piece, and for those who don't, you probably know about it without knowing about it. This has been featured in the music has been featured in movies, in commercials, and all kinds of commercial aspects. And it is exciting and wonderful. And we're adding a new component this year, which we're very, very excited to be doing. We're going to be working with the Classical Dance Arts with Mark and Linda Darling, and presenting it as a ballet. And so we are absolutely thrilled to be working with them. We've been meeting already monthly for 3 months, getting all of our P's and Q's together. Working with the Darlings has been absolutely delightful.
Wow. And so do you even know at this point what that collaboration is going to even mean in terms of what people are going to see, or does that remain to be seen?
Well, I think it's somewhat rare. This piece was originally meant to be a ballet. It was supposed to be very visually stunning as well as acoustically stunning. But it's not done that often in our area. I know Milwaukee's done it a couple times some years back, but it's not very common to see this done as a ballet, especially in a community our size. And so this is quite a big undertaking. This ballet company is really hitting an artistic groove, so to speak. A number of their dancers over the past years have gone to some of the finest schools in the country for dance, and Mark and Linda have done a terrific job of developing some very, very fine dancers. And so this is going to be quite a feast for the eyes.
Wow, that should be really, really cool. And just to clarify for our listeners who might not immediately recognize the title and might not think they know anything by Carl Orff and Carmina Burana, here's just a sample. So that is the incredibly familiar music that Tim Schatzman was referring to, of course, the O Fortuna from Carl Orff's dramatic cantata, Carmina Burana. And again, performed in collaboration with the studio artistic team, the ballet dancers of Mark and Linda Darling. That will be March 17th and 18th on the main stage of the University of Wisconsin Parkside, yes, in that beautiful Rita facility that they have. And then if all of that wasn't enough, you are ending the season in most intriguing fashion with a concert, it looks like you are calling Migration. Tell us about this.
Migration is an interesting concept. I mean, if you think about it, the world population has been migrating forever. I mean, people move from one place to another due to wars, famines, opportunity. People just generally move. We're not a very static people, I don't think. And so we're putting a program together that really is delving deeply into the area of what it means for people to move when they go from one place to another. What is that like? And these, we have two very different works that are presenting. One is a piece arranged by Mark Brimer that uses Irish folk songs. It's called Letters from Ireland. And is accompanied by an Irish band, and interspersed, not unlike Lessons and Carols, with letters from actual people who passed through Ellis Island about what their experiences was.
Wow.
Their experience of curiosity, and maybe mixed with a little reticence of what have I stepped into, coming to this new country where I don't know the language, I don't know the culture, I may not have family here. I'm going to have to strike out on my own and figure out where my place is and what is it going to be like. And I think when people move from one country to another, that's often the lost part of the dialogue, is the human element. When we're talking about immigration or illegal immigrants, whatever term you choose to use, people have been coming to the United States for opportunity for more than 100 years, maybe more than 200 years. And so both these works kind of delve into the psychology of that a little bit from the perspective of the person making the move. And it really, I think, will touch a nerve, because almost all of us, all of us migrated here at some point. Even Native Americans migrated to this country. And so this idea of what it means to just pack up your bags and leave, often leaving the majority of your family behind to strike out to a new opportunity, is really the central theme of this particular concert.
Hmm. So explain the music that's going to be offered up, or at least some of it.
Mm-hmm. The piece, like I said, is built on Irish folk songs. And so these are going to be songs you're going to know and be pretty familiar with. They're going to be accompanied by a pretty robust Irish band with Irish percussion and fiddles and flutes. And so you're going to hear some of those Celtic sounds actually enhancing this piece. It's definitely the lighter piece of the two on the program. It should be absolutely delightful. The other piece called The Golden Door by Ron Pereira is a little more edgy and talks a little bit, it brings it more into contemporary terms. And what does it mean to be coming from another country when you may not be terribly welcomed? How does that play on the person trying to get their make their opportunity and put their roots down? And how does that change the dynamic of entering the country, which may be a mix of enthusiasm and terror? And so how do you work those through and walk into the unknown? If you're coming from a war-torn country, you're kind of excited to leave that difficulty behind you, or you're at least happy to put that behind you. But to be coming into a country where you may not be as welcomed as it could be. Mm. So that's part of the theme of this particular work, and it goes into that rather deeply.
Wow. Sounds powerful. So that will be the way that the season ends then in the middle of May, March 12th, at First Presbyterian Church, yet another beautiful space for making music.
And a space that was on the Underground Railroad, so it has a connection to this migration topic.
Excellent. So that's the season then, four offerings in all, and we want to remind people about the first one once again, Gilbert and Sullivan's wonderful early collaboration, Trial by Jury. Two performances happening this Saturday, 3 and 7, at the Racine City Council Chambers in Racine's City Hall. And Jim, if people want information about anything that they've heard, including information about tickets for Saturday's performance, what do they do? How can they contact Choral Arts?
They can go to our website, where at this point you can reserve a ticket and it'll be held at will call. Or you can call the office at 634-3250. That's 634-3250. Or you can pick up tickets at Julie's Personal Touch Flowers, which is one of our outlets.
Fantastic. We're going to, before part two of today's program, listen into the final couple minutes of Trial by Jury by Gilbert and Sullivan. And again, thank you, Jim Schatzman, for all you do in the community and for all that you've done with Choral Arts over the years. And we wish you and your singers a very, very successful season and especially a wonderful time with Trial by Jury this Saturday.
Thank you, Greg.
Here's the conclusion to Trial by Jury.
I do object.
I do object.
I don't object.
With all respect, I do object. I do object. I do object.
All the legal fury sees you. No proposal seems to please you. I can't sit up here all day. I must shortly get away. Barristers and you attorneys, set out on your homeward journeys. Gentle, simple-minded usher, get you if you like to Russia. Put your briefs upon the shelf. I will marry her myself.
Seems to me, sir, such as she, sir, the judge is Isa and a good judge too.
Oh, joy unbounded, prepare, surrounded, the name is sounded of three and four.
It seems to me, sir, such as she, sir, the judge is Isa
and a good judge too. Oh, joy unbounded, prepare,
the conclusion of Trial by Jury of Gilbert and Sullivan, and here's part two of today's morning show. We're going to spend this portion of WGTD's morning show talking about a really interesting and wonderful event that is designed to get children and adults reading together. And not just in the sense of reading together in pairs, but reading together by the millions. Jumpstart's Read for the Record is an event over the course of 24 hours in which millions of people are invited to read the same book on the same day. And there are families and schools and churches and community centers all across the country that participate in Read for the Record. And this particular time around, the event is centered around a delightful new children's book called Quackers. And we're going to be talking for the next few minutes with the author of this book, Quackers, Liz Wong, a very, very talented writer and artist, actually born in Honolulu, Hawaii. And she brings a wealth of life experiences and gifts to the writing of this delightful book. And I'm excited to be able to speak with her. The book, by the way, is published by Alfred A. Knopf. Liz Wong, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm very excited to be talking with you. Tell our listeners a little bit about the life that you have led and sort of the road that leads you to this place where you are now creating children's books.
Sure. I was one of those kids who always loved to draw all the time. By the time I was in first grade, I decided I was going to be an artist when I grew up. And I did go to college for art, but I thought I was going to be a sculptor. And it took me a long time to realize that I wanted to make children's books and that people made children's books. I'm not really sure where I thought they came from, but they were made in a factory somewhere. And I realized that actually just normal people make children's books, and that could be a career for me. And so I started as an illustrator, and then along the way began having ideas for stories. It took me a while to figure out how to actually write those stories and make them into something that was publishable.
Hmm. Let's talk for a moment about the business of illustrating children's books, which is kind of where all this began. What would you think about, and what do you think about today? And for instance, as you illustrated this delightful book, Quackers, what do you think about in terms of the best way or the most effective way to illustrate a book with children in mind?
Well, there's a couple things that I usually think about. Picture books are very short, so you have to get what you want to say across in 500 words or less. Challenging. And also, you want to think about the age of the kids that you're writing for and illustrating for. So when I was working on Quackers, I had to think about what the illustrations would look like and what would appeal to young children. It's not my normal illustration style, so I had to spend some time figuring out how I would execute the book in such a way that it was really cute and appealing. And then also making sure that the pictures and the words work together. And sometimes they work against each other. For example, the first page has a picture of a cat, but it says that Quackers is a duck.
Right. And from there ensues this this delightful story that we'll talk about in just a second. When you are specifically illustrating a book, are you, in a sense, editing your work in the sense of a writer writing a book might try something and, no, that's not quite right, and oh, in the old days, crumple up the paper and into the wastebasket. Nowadays, you just hit delete and try again. But when it comes to, for instance, illustration, even with something that at a glance might seem like a relatively simple project like illustrating a children's book, is it a similar kind of process of trial and error and working slowly to get it just right? Or is the process different than that?
I would say that it is definitely a process. You hit it right on the head. I sketch out all of the illustrations first. I do little tiny sketches and then enlarge them and move things around if I don't think they're working right. You also have to figure out where you're going to put the text, so you have to leave room for that. And sometimes you come across things as you're working on the book that you don't realize aren't going to work out until you get to it. For example, I had a scene where Quackers is returning to the duck pond, and I was drawing the back of his head, and I realized that I couldn't figure out how the stripes on his head would match up on the back. So I ended up turning him to be in profile, so I didn't have to draw the back of his head, and I still don't know what the back of his head looks like.
So we've probably danced around this enough. Let's talk for a moment about the book. Quackers, and again, this is the book that has been selected, I should say, for this year's Jumpstart Read for the Record event coming up on Thursday the 19th. Tell us where you got the idea for this story, and also share with our audience just kind of the kernel of the story itself.
Well, the story is about a cat who thinks he is a duck because he lives in a duck pond, and really that's all he knows. And eventually, he does meet another cat and realizes that he is, in fact, a cat. And he goes through a little mini identity crisis and then ends up realizing that he doesn't have to choose between being a cat and a duck, and he can be both. And so his family is really composed of both cats and ducks. And I got this idea because one day I drew a picture of a cat, and I thought it would be really funny if the text said that he was a duck. Because that's the brilliant thing about picture books, is that sometimes the words work together and sometimes they work opposite from each other. But I had to come up with a story from there. I started to think about myself and times in my life where I felt like I was different and didn't fit in. I'm also half Asian, half white, so I've had a lot of identity crises along the way. And had to spend some time figuring out where I fit in the world. So that ended up kind of informing Quacker's story as he was trying to figure out who he was.
Very nice. Your biography mentions that you are married with a son. I'm just curious if your son is of the age where you think about him very specifically when, for instance, you are creating a book like Quackers.
My son is now 9, so he's at the point where he's really into Harry Potter and not really interested in my picture book so much anymore. But, you know, the wonderful thing about having a child is that I read so many picture books to him as he was growing up. And there are a lot of books that I did not understand or appreciate as an adult, but then once I read them to him and saw how excited and delighted he was by them, then I really started to get it. So having a child really gave me a different perspective on picture books.
We're speaking with Liz Wong, a children's book author and illustrator, whose book Quackers has been selected for this year's Jumpstart Read for the Record. So on Thursday, October 19th, literally millions of people across the country are going to be participating in this 24-hour celebration in which young and old alike are invited to read on the 19th this book. And, of course, maybe talk about it and sort of collectively celebrate the joy of reading. Liz Wong, tell us a little bit about the experience of having your book selected for Read for the Record. How did that happen?
I really don't know how they chose my book. It's been sort of astounding to me that they managed to pick my book out of all the other books that were published last year, but I was very fortunate that it happened. My editor, who worked on the book, told me that it had been selected, and it took me a little while to process that 2 million people were going to read it, and then I just basically started crying because I was so overwhelmed and so joyful and so thankful that they picked my book. And you know, when you get a book published, you think maybe the people that you're related to will read it, and you hope some people that you're not directly related to will read it. But to have 2 million people reading it is really astounding.
So what do you see as the greatest benefits of this particular event, Read for the Record? What kind of difference do you think it potentially makes?
Well, Read for the Record is really to highlight the importance of early literacy and to not only to celebrate the joy of reading together with kids, but to put a spotlight upon the importance of strong literacy and language skills in children. Jumpstart's really focused on making sure that preschool children are prepared to enter kindergarten ready to read, and particularly focused on underserved communities. So Read for the Record is not only, you know, a really great, exciting event, but a chance to put a spotlight on those issues and to highlight the importance of adults and children reading together.
You said you really don't know the process by which your book got selected. Nevertheless, I'm sure you understand all of the ways in which your book is actually a terrific choice for this particular program. At the risk of asking you to toot your own horn, I'd like you to say a word about how you think this book, Quackers, can work really, really well for an event like Read for the Record.
Well, you know, when I was writing this book, I was thinking really about myself. But along the way, I was trying to make a good story, you know, a really good, entertaining story. And along the way, it kind of ended up with this message of acceptance and love and kindness. And so I think that's what propelled Jumpstart to choose my book for this event. And so I hope that readers will take that away with them, that message of acceptance, that kids will know that it's okay to be different, it's okay not to fit in, that you can find your place in the world no matter who you are, and that they should treat everyone with love and kindness and tolerance. It's been a really wonderful surprise to talk to kids and hear some of their stories about ways that they didn't fit in and how they have identified with Quackers in ways that I did not predict. And they have made this book really a lot more meaningful than I even knew that it was.
Again, the book is Quackers, published by Alfred A. Knopf, and its writer and illustrator, Liz Wong. And again, this is the book that is selected for this year's Read for the Record event under the auspices of Jumpstart. Liz Wong, this has been a great pleasure to speak with you, and congratulations on your selection, or the selection of your book to be part of Read for the Record. And we wish you many more years of happy and successful writing. And thank you for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you so much for